stand by. Welcome and thank you for joining us for today's IBM teleconference, Quicker DB2 Recovery, Tips from the Trenches. Today's teleconference will last approximately 60 minutes and will include a live question and answer session. In this teleconference, we'll take away some tips on executing timely recoveries on DB2 databases. We'll share with you proven ways to reduce recovery times, whether doing a table space recovery or a full-blown disaster recovery test. The speaker for today's teleconference is Robert Goodman, Senior DBA and Disaster Recovery Coordinator, Florida Hospital. At this time, I'd like to turn the program over to Mr. Robert Goodman. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Welcome to the session on Quicker DB2 Recovery, Tips from the Trenches. The major points that we're going to cover will first deal with DB2 backup and recovery. Secondly, periodic tasks that streamline DB2 recoveries. Third, a comparison of backup and recovery strategies. Fourth, some DB2 parameters that make a really big difference with recovery. And finally, the latest recovery techniques and tricks of the trade. We're going to focus in on a holistic approach to DB2 recovery. The first and foremost thing we want to do is to prevent the need to recover. Secondly, if we do have to recover, we want quick and accurate problem determination, followed by recovery automation. We want to avoid errors during the recovery process. We want to come to the correct recovery point, and then we want to recover as quickly as possible. And really, when we have the marriage of all of these factors together, we have recovery success. How are your recovery skills? You know, it's kind of interesting because when we talk about DB2 recovery, it's always under the very worst conditions, at the worst time, and the people in your office typically could be the CIO or CTO. So it's important that we hone our skills. Our recovery skills need to be rock solid to support our 21st century businesses. When we talk about DB2 recovery, there are a number of things that we can recover. First of all, we can recover logical page lists. And this is largely automated within DB2 now in the more current versions. Secondly, we can recover page sets. And this would include both table space page sets and more recently, index space page sets. And finally, we can look at recovering entire DB2 subsystems. Now, it's important to note that DB2 does not back up or recover tables. Going on to the DB2 table space copy concept, we realize that in order to recover, we have to have a point to recover from. And this is accomplished through copies. Basically, within a copy, we copy a table space or index space. It writes it out to either disk or tape. It's registered in a special table called sysibm.syscopy, and it's also registered in the active logs. That after reorgs, loads, or rotates, a full image copy is required to be recoverable. DB2 also has the ability to copy index spaces. And when you look at this, it's just like the table space copy concept. We back up an index space to either disk or tape. It's registered in syscopy and also in the active logs. Now, there's one thing to remember with index space copies. Make sure that the copy indexes have the copy yes attribute turned on. If you fail to do this, then you won't be able to use a recover on an index. You'd have to rebuild it instead. Now, once we've made our copies, the next thing is we're able to do recoveries. And so we're going to go briefly through the recovery, the table space recovery concept. We start with our syscopy with the utility. It goes out there and finds the individual image copies that are needed. These could be on tape or disk. It goes out to syslograngex to find out the periods during which this table space was being actively updated. It looks at the bootstrap data sets and the archive and active logs. Using a combination of all of these, it can do a table space recovery. Now, it's interesting within DB2, we have a number of options. If we specify nothing, the table space will recover to current. However, we can also recover to an RBA, to a log point, to a particular page, to copy, to last copy, to last full copy, or we can do a log-only recovery. The report recovery utility tells us exactly what resources will be used. Next, we'll look at the rebuild versus the recover index. Now, when we rebuild an index, it basically goes out and reads the table space pages and builds the index from scratch. And all indexes can be rebuilt. To recover an index, we have a couple of prerequisites. First of all, before we do the image copy, we should alter index, copy yes. This sets up the catalog so that it will register and says copies the copies that we're making. If we fail to do this, we will have to rebuild the indexes. The other prerequisite for an index recovery is obviously we have to make an image copy of the index. And another important thing to note is if the image copies are unavailable or unusable, an index can always be rebuilt. Next, we'll review the concept of rebuilding an index. Basically, in order to rebuild an index, DB2 has to scan the table space. It sorts down the information it extracts to put it in the correct order for the index, and then it creates the index. Continuing with the recover index concept, when you look at this, it looks much like the recover table space concepts. And the reason is, it works almost exactly the same. When you do a recovery of an index, it goes out and goes out to syscopy to find out what resources are available. Then it determines which image copies, could be on disk or tape, are needed. It goes to syslograngex to find out the times during which the index was being updated. It goes to the BSDS, the archive logs, and the active logs. And once it's gathered all this information, it can recover the index. And it works just like a table space recover. It puts down the pages of the index, and then it applies the logs. Now, there are a number of critical recovery resources that are necessary in any DB2 recovery. First of all, we have to make sure that we have enough tape drives if we're using tapes. We have to make sure we have both enough DB2 DASD as well as adequate work DASD. And we also need to make sure that our buffer pools are sized sufficiently. It's important to note that we can have a number of system constraints that can affect our recoveries. We could have inadequate tape, CPU, I/O, memory, buffers, or extents. And so it's important that we monitor these resources, and we'll look at some of the factors that help us to make sure our recoveries run effectively. We're going to look at these six major categories of things that make a big, big difference with DB2 recovery. First of all is the overall health of the DB2 subsystem. Secondly, we'll look at some of the things that we can do with image copies that will affect our recoverability. Third, we'll look at a number of housekeeping tasks that will help us with our recoveries as well. Fourth, we'll look at the recovery utility and many of the options we can use or not use there. We'll look at the cost of rebuilding indexes versus recovering indexes. And finally, we'll look at overall disaster recovery strategies. And this is the time really when we do massive recoveries. Tip number one, properly size your DB2 logs. We have active logs, and these are logs that are available immediately on disk. We have secondary logs called archive logs, and this happens when DB2 externalizes the logs. Typically, this will happen to tape. DB2 works in a round-robin fashion and goes and rotates between different logs. If we have 20 pairs, it will go and it will overwrite the first log, the second log, the third log, and so forth, until it gets to number 20, in which case it will go and rewrite over active log 1. At this point, the data that was on this log would not be available on disk, but we might have to go back to tape. And tape logs are serial devices and very slow. So it's important that we have adequate logs. Now, typically in our shop, we have at least 32 hours of active logs on disk available. And this covers us adequately since we try to back everything up every 24 hours using image copies. So this backs us up so that if we need to do a recovery, we don't have to use any of the archive logs that are on tape. Undersized active logs can force you to use archive tapes in your log recovery process. And the problem with this, of course, is that you have to get a tape mount, and also they're serial so that only in an example where you have to do multiple recoveries at once, only one job stream could use the logs at a single time if they're archive logs as opposed to active logs. So all these factors make it important to properly size your DB2 logs. Tip number two, enable fast log apply. And this requires, of course, DB2 version 6 or higher. That really shouldn't be a problem with any of us. But we must enable this feature as well. And we enable it by giving it a storage allocation up to 100 megabytes. And 100 megabytes is the default in version 8 and beyond. And the reason that they made it a default is fast log apply allows us to recover and bring up DB2 much quicker. In fact, it's shown that it cuts recovery time by up to 33%. This is really, really significant. The way it does it is it reads logs. Logs are read, sorted, and applied in parallel. And so this is what speeds up the processing. And fast log apply is always available for DB2 on a DB2 restart. Another thing we need to do is to manage deferred restart. And when we say manage it, deferred restart basically allows us to defer recovering all of DB2's page sets prior to DB2 becoming available. This is controlled by two factors. One is called limit backout, and that can be set either to yes or to auto. Depends on your environment. This is something you'd have to discuss with your systems DBAs and your systems programmers, and also the backout duration. These two factors affect how DB2 will behave with deferred restart. These postpone backout processing when DB2 starts up. The reason you would want to do this is if you had a very long-running unit of work that was doing a lot of updating and you didn't have deferred restart turned on, all of its backout would have to be done prior to DB2 being available and coming up for the rest of the system. And this could be a big, big issue. Deferred restart, setting these parameters correctly, allow you to bring your DB2 up in a very consistent time frame. Another thing that is very important with DB2 is to eliminate long-running units of work. And they can be detected by looking for the message DSNR035I. And you'll find these in the DB2 log master. And the message is uncommitted unit of recovery after, and then there's a number and checkpoints. And this shows you basically badly behaving programs that do not commit frequently enough. Now, typically the way to solve this is you may want to resolve it by assigning problem tickets to these long-running units of work. So you would assign it to the batch processes typically, and you would assign a trouble ticket to that, but they need to fix and add commit logic to their program. Another way that you can do this is you can actually use NetView to detect this message and to automatically cancel long-running units of work. But this would be dependent on how you are in your shop, what your situation is, and how you can handle that. The bottom line, though, is you will want to enable the unit of recovery check frequency so that you can detect these long-running units of work. Next, we'll look at system-wide recovery. This gives you the ability to recover DB2 system-wise so the entire instance can be recovered. And it can be accomplished with the backup system and restore system commands. Now, there are some prerequisites. You have to be on ZOS 1.5 or above. You have to enable flash copy and have that feature enabled on your system. Everything needs to be in SMS copy pools and so on and so forth. Now, this is especially an ideal situation for ERPs that may have thousands to tens of thousands of table spaces and indexes. because what it allows you to do is to back up your entire system with one command, and then and a very minimal outage as well. And so starting in version 8, this was available. It got much, much better in version 9 as well. And so if you run ERPs especially, this may be something that you want to look at as an option. Copy frequency is another very important thing for DBAs to be aware of. And there are factors that affect copy frequency. How frequently should I copy? Well, one of the things is how frequently do I update, and what is my recovery time objective? How long can I take to do a recovery? And so you have to weigh these two factors, the recovery time versus the copy time. Now, fortunately, all of the copy utilities on the markets have a very good copy share level change features, so copy is no longer as intrusive as it once was. But you still have to weigh the cost of both the tapes and the CPU and so forth of running copies. How frequent is frequent enough? Well, we look at things and say, well, we want to be able to recover within 6 hours any table on the system. And so we have some very high updaters that basically hit the logs very frequently. And for those very high updaters, we actually opt to copy them, full copy them twice per day. Most of our normal table spaces we would recover, image copy only once a day. So the more frequently you copy, the less time it will take to do recovery. And conversely, the less frequently you copy, the more time it will take to recover. So this is something that you can find out based on your environment and based on running some tests as well. Next, we'll look at backup strategies. And in order to understand backup strategies, we've got to describe the recovery granularity. How granular are we making our copies? What's our recovery point objective, which is how much data we can afford to lose? And our recovery time objective, which is what's the total amount of time it will take from the time they say start to finish the recovery. And this also will affect whether we decide to back up indexes, for instance. We need to have an off-site and an on-site strategy, because if we lose our primary site, we need to have copies available to do a recovery off-site as well. We will also need to look at the frequency that we off-site transport our off-site copies. In our shop, we elected to do that twice per day because basically we're running image copies 24 hours a day. And so pulling twice a day means that we would only lose on average 12 hours of data versus doing it once a day. We could lose up to 24 hours of data. And so these are considerations you need to think about. And then you need to look at your overall disaster recovery strategy. And the question that you need to ask yourself is, does your recovery strategy match your recovery objectives? So you need to quantify these things in your environment, find out what the recovery time objectives are, and once you understand those, you can tailor your image copies or whatever your strategy is to meet these needs. Next, we'll look at a technique of stacking copies on tapes. And this is something that we had to do manually in the past. Now with the newer versions of DB2, there are some image copy options that will allow you to automatically stack without having to do all the JCL changes as well. But there are a number of factors when you start to stack copies on tape. And those include things like the number of table spaces you want to put on each tape. You might want to look at the number of tapes that you're going to actually write to. And the reason is that tape tends to be a little less dependable than disk. And as such, occasionally you'll get an error, not too frequently, but occasionally. And you might want to look at how long it would take to restart a job on average. So, for instance, in our shop, we say that we don't want tape image copies running more than an hour. And that means, on average, if one of those were to fail, that it would take up to a half an hour or roughly a half an hour of wall time is what we would lose. Now, if you have image copies and you're stacking a whole lot of stuff and it's running 4 or 5 hours, if you have a failure, then you're looking at quite a bit longer time to restart as well. There are a number of options within DB2 utilities to automatically stack things on tape, and you can use that with wildcards and templates and so forth. And so we would encourage you to investigate those options, and all of those are very, very viable. You might also look at the frequency and urgency of your copies. And in order to do that, you kind of look at the I/O characteristics of the data sets and stack things with similar I/O characteristics on the same tape. This requires a little more management. It's not as automated, but what it can do for you on the other side, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, is it will help you recover quicker on the other side, because you'll have just one or two jobs with massive log apply versus spreading that across all your image copy jobs. And so you also want to look at your granularity. Are you backing up partition table spaces at the table space level or at the partition level? Now, if you create image copies at the partition level, that's also the level at which you can recover. And as you know, it would be much quicker to recover one partition that had been corrupted than having to recover all of the partitions, because that's the level you did the image copies at. So these are all things that you'll want to look at as factors. Now, one technique that we've used is to copy active partition and its indexes. So the hot indexes, which would be the partitioning and perhaps the non-partitioning indexes, all in the same job. Now, the reason that you would do that is that when it comes to the recovery side of the equation, that they all have similar log apply. And so they would all be passing, in fact, and selecting the same range and types of log records. And so it's much more efficient on the recover side. If you back them up this way, then you can also recover them. And if you think about it, typically in a recovery, you may have to recover, especially in disaster recovery, all of these components anyway. And so it's much more efficient to stack them all on the same tape as the active partition. We've also taken a technique where we've grouped our image copies by I/O characteristics. And this is basically for the purpose of disaster recovery. What we noted over the years was when we had basically image copies and correspondingly recoveries by, say, subsystems, so we're looking at pharmacy or lab, and we would have some table spaces within each of those that would be very high updaters. We'd have most would be normal updaters, so random but not real frequent updates, and then we'd have some that were read-only. At one of our disaster recovery tests, we decided that we would do a test and see if we could recover quicker if we isolated and grouped by I/O characteristics. And what we found was that read-only image copies, well, basically it slammed the data down. There was little to no log apply because these are read-only. So they were very quick. They were in and out. The normal updaters, they were also very quick. They would slam the data down on the disk and then do a fairly sparse log apply, and then the jobs would finish. And our high updaters that were these are also the types of tables that we actually image copy twice a day. They would be very, very log intensive, and they could actually run for a couple of hours. But by grouping all of those together on the same image copy, what we found out what happened was we would throw those things in first, let them grind away. Most of our other stuff would just whip on through rather than it taking a long time because one of the page sets on the copy was a very high I/O updater. And so it really had to do with log apply. So this is kind of a strategy you can look at, you know, if your tapes and trucks for disaster recovery. This can make a difference. Another option you can look at is actually doing your image copies to disk rather than tape. And as disk gets cheaper and cheaper and gets closer to the price of tape, this offers a very real and viable alternative. What it will do is it will speed not only your image copies, but also your recoveries. since it can randomly access these things on disk. Next, we'll look at the kind of one of the housekeeping activities we all need to do within DB2 recovery, and that's to use the Modify Recover utility. And basically what it does is it deletes old entries from syscopy and syslogrange. And bottom line is this speeds the overall recovery process because it's got less things to look at. And the Modify Recover tablespace automatically cleans up these old copies and versions. Basically, it takes them out from being available for recovery. And so in our example here, we see that syscopy and syslogrange are pruned during this process. Another thing that we can do to speed up recovery is to drop some of our unneeded stuff, as we say, or page sets. And we can look at, and this makes sense because from the bigger standpoint, if you've got stuff that's not being used, you've got table spaces or indexes that aren't being used, you're probably, if you've got a good audit, you're probably having to back up those things. And at disaster recovery, you're probably recovering them as well. And if they're no longer needed, if they've been retired, it's a good idea to go ahead and clean those things up. And this can also, in the process, you'll clean up views, and then you'll need to make sure that you don't have any leftover aliases as well. And one of the unique things with aliases is you can drop the underlying table, index, table space, and so on and so forth in the views, but the aliases will stay out there. They're persistent because they can also be created prior to the object being there. And they're really needed for, this was a need for a distributed environment where you might not be connected yet, but you could go ahead and build the name so that you could talk to that alias. So this is important as well, just to keep things tidy. Next, we'll look at some DB2 audits that you'll typically want to do. First thing you want to look at is to make sure you don't have too many sys atoms or DB atoms or system controls and so forth, because over time the organization changes and responsibilities and roles change, and you want to make sure that your sysatoms match your current sysatoms. You want to make sure that you are compressing where it makes sense and not compressing when it doesn't make sense. Some people have opted to compress everything, and they found out that there is an overhead to this. So you want to kind of make sure that compressed data is done sensibly. You want to audit the commit frequency. We already kind of touched on that. You want to make sure that you have restrict on drop on your production tables, and this prevents them from being accidentally dropped. And this is one of those things that will prevent you from having to do a recovery. You want to routinely audit for reorg pending and advisory reorg table spaces. You want to look at both tables and indexes with high version numbers, high extent numbers, under allocations and over allocations, and you'll want to also routinely audit log no table spaces to make sure that's not a mistake. Typically, log no is only turned on for very short periods of times. All of these routine audits can help prevent the need to recover. And remember, that was the first foundation stone on our ladder to recovery success. Next, we'll look at some more on audits, and we might ask some questions. How many of you have lots of multi-data set segmented table spaces? And you've got to look at these because these are difficult to run utilities on, and they also take much longer to do a recover table space as well. How many have partition table spaces that are getting close to DS size limits on partitions? And these are also issues in recovery and just general manageability. How many of you have small partitioned, non-extended attribute table spaces that are almost full? Another thing that can put you in a bad situation. How many of you have audits to detect these conditions prior to death by hitting the wall? And this is really what we're talking about with audits, is knowing when to do these things in advance. All of these conditions can force you into recovery based on different situations. So these are all things that routine audits can help you avoid a recovery situation. We're also going to look at auditing image copies. You want to make sure you've got all table spaces, all partitions. You want to make sure that you don't have any unrecoverable table spaces. And those would be things that haven't been copied since the last reorg, the last load, or in version 8, starting with version 8, we have rotate, which can also put these in a state to where they can't be recovered unless we do an image copy. We want to look at all indexes. If we're image copying them, we should have the copy yes attribute on. And we want to look at the timeliness of our image copies. We want to make sure that we're doing both on-site and off-site image copies. So auditing just that we have on-site copies is not enough. And then we also want to audit on the opposite side to see if we have any extremely old copies. Now, bottom line is if you don't copy, you can't recover. So housekeeping on all of these things is very important. Another important thing to look at is high extents and eliminating high extents. Now, you might wonder why this might be significant, and we put a graph up here, and these are actually benchmarks of some things we did. We benchmarked a two-copy recovery, so there's no log apply involved, and we looked at two scenarios, one where we had two extents for data and indexes, and the other one was where we had 200-plus extents for data and indexes. And the bottom line was that we ran 8 times faster when we had fewer extents, 2 extents versus 200. Now, the reason for this is each time that DB2 or anything under ZOS has to go out and get an extent, it's got to go back to ZOS. And in relative terms, that's a slow process. And so even though these extents don't hurt us from a performance standpoint day-to-day operationally that much, that's gotten very good. From a recovery or a utility standpoint, your utilities can run much, much, much slower. And so we would advise that you look at this. These are our actual benchmarks from some tests we did. And you might want to alter your high extent objects prior to recovery so that they're getting bigger chunks. And, of course, there's another option within DB2, which is sliding secondaries, and this could also help eliminate the high extent performance issues you can get in a recovery. And the reason this is critical to a recovery is, of course, we're always in a rush to recover quickly and to have recover take much, much longer just due to a lot of extents is really not acceptable. We also want to minimize recovery, and we're going to look at logical page list recovery. In DB2 version 7 and earlier, it was largely a manual process. Starting with version 8, LPL cleanup is pretty much automatic. Now, occasionally, if something doesn't clean, you can do a DB2 start on that table space or index space, and in general, it will clean it up. Normally, you don't have to do anything with this. Normally, DB2 would automatically clean it up. But you need to be aware that if it doesn't work, that you can do a start database to resolve this issue. And you can detect and notify yourself of these logical page list recoveries because you may not be aware of them. You can use NetView to send you a message to let you know that this is happening. Dynamic allocations are another very important thing, and now we're looking at things with the recovery utility. And the reason that they're important is when you use dynamic data set allocation, provided you have adequate workspace on your packs, you're not going to over-allocate, you're not going to under-allocate, and you're not going to miss allocating a data set. And so this is going to be much more accurate. And as a result, it's going to be much more dependable. And the worst thing you can have happen is have a utility run for 45 minutes and find out you have 16 extents and you can't extend any farther and then you fail. Because inevitably, when you run into recovery, you usually have the chief technology or chief information officer over your shoulders asking the question over and over again, when are we going to be done? How long is it going to take? And so to be that far into a utility and then have it fail is just really unacceptable. Now, fortunately, the DB2 recovery utility has very good use of dynamic allocation. And you see in the example here, we show you the template for doing those dynamic data set allocations. And your work data sets, the way they're dynamically allocated is you simply leave them out. And so things run much, much better. Another real tip with the DB2 recovery utility is to recover multiple items in one pass. And what you see in the example at the bottom of the page with the X across it is we do recover table space, recover table space, recover table space, and so on and so forth. And what that would do is it would recover the table space, which you'll remember it lays down the page sets, it slams down those things on the data set, and then it does a log apply. And then it ends. And then it does the next recover, slam it down on disk, log apply. The difference with the example on the top is that there is a single log apply. And so this is a very, very nice thing to have happen, and it speeds your recovery or process. So in this example, we have the table space being partition 9 being laid down, the partitioning index being laid down, and then all of our non-partitioning indexes, and then it's doing log apply in one single pass on all of those. And what you'll find out, what we found out in our disaster recovery testing, was that this is significantly faster than passing the log multiple times. We also look at a technique of retaining tape mounts, and this is very, very important as well. Now, starting in DB2.8 and beyond, this is really not an issue, providing you use the parallel keyword to invoke this, and it will basically retain the mounts. Versus prior to this, if you didn't use one of these techniques, either allocating the DDs, it will lay down the data set, rewind the tape, go back to the beginning, remount it, wind to where you want to go, lay it down, rewind. And so what we found was most of our time was taken in rewinding and winding forward to find the data sets. So we would recommend that you investigate the use of this parallel keyword to reduce the need for tape mounts and rewinds, which are very, very slow. Another key is if you image copy your partitions and indexes together, is to go ahead and recover those together. And the way they do that is you do one recover statement, you list your table space, and then all of the index spaces that you want to recover as well. And the reason that this speeds recovery is that all of them have similar log apply for these active sets. And so this is a very, very effective way of speeding the overall recovery process. And this is especially effective in your disaster recovery scenario where you're going to recover both the table space and all of the indexes. Another thing we can do is we can recover our indexes in parallel. And so you'll see once again we're saying parallel four. We're going to get four parallel threads here going. And so we are doing this in parallel. And anytime we can go in parallel, it's going to cost us some additional CPU at the cost of, or at the benefit of, really, reduced elapsed time. And when we're talking about table space recovery, reducing elapsed time is the whole game. How can we do it quicker? Now, here we have a comparison of the rebuild versus the recover index. And we did quite a bit of testing of this at one of our disaster recovery tests to see what the difference was. And when we rebuild an index, of course, it reads the data and rebuilds the index from the data that it had. When we do the recover, it basically slams down the index to the disk and then log applies. And so the question would be, which one works better? When do we use rebuild? Well, we use rebuild on small, medium, and large table spaces and indexes. We use rebuild on large table spaces and indexes with a fair amount of updates. We use rebuild index on all indexes that are not image copies, and in most cases we found that it was faster than recover due to some other improvements that IBM has made. When did we use recover? Basically for large read-only index spaces and for large periodically updated table spaces and indexes. And so you have to look at these factors, and also you can test these factors as well. Now another thing that's real key with the rebuild index utility is the use of the sort keys option. And luckily in version 8 and beyond, this is the default. You don't want to undo this, because in our tests, what we found was that it cost us more CPU, but we got much, much quicker results by using the sort keys option in the rebuild index. And that's the reason, really, that IBM made it the default for version 8 rebuild index utility. Next, we'll look at the rebuild index all. And we found in our testing that if we were building more than two indexes, we would use both the sort keys and the index all in order to do this. Now, traditionally in the past, we'd run parallel jobs that would build indexes over the same table in parallel at the same time. But in our more recent testing in version 8 and beyond, we found that sort keys and index all for anything that had more than two indexes outran and outperformed the older technique. Now, one of the things that we've got to do as we move through the different versions of DB2 is to continue to test the options that are available and make sure that they are still valid. And this was one case where we found that using the newer options actually gave us much better throughput. Another thing we can do, and this has to do with usability, is to omit the sysute 1DD when we're recovering or rebuilding an index. This makes this rebuild index not restartable. From our experience, it never was terribly restartable even when we left this in, but it makes things run much, much quicker. And if you use the sort keys option, in fact, it disables this under the covers. What this does is it eliminates work data sets to where DB2 directly writes out to the indexes. And this is the default in version 8. And once again, the reason it's the default is it's a much higher performing option overall. Bottom line is if you've got these things hard-coded from earlier versions, you may want to go back and look at this and take these things out. Now, another thing that we found for disaster recovery, and disaster recovery is where you basically are recovering all of your table spaces and page sets, is that we did a test at the end of one of our DR tests and found out that if we balanced our image copies and conversely our recoveries by I/O characteristics, that we actually improved our overall throughput. And once again, this would be something you could test at disaster recovery by stacking things with similar I/O characteristics on the same tapes, and then just seeing if your total elapsed time of the whole entire recovery went down. And the reason that this seemed to work for us was that when we just randomly did image copies, but say by subsystem, the issue was that we'd have some real high updaters in most every subsystem. Well, they would keep all of the recovered page sets in a recovery status for a long time while they were doing log apply for these one or two page sets that were high up I/O updaters. And so that slowed down our overall throughput. By grouping things by I/O characteristics, the read-only ran really fast, the normal read-write ran pretty fast, and the read-write intensive recoveries ran long as they always had, but there were many fewer jobs to do that. We already talked about the importance of having adequate log data sets. When you go to disaster recovery, you can actually take your tape logs, your tape archive logs, and write them out to disk at the beginning of the test. And that way, multiple recoveries can access these logs. You can have random access of the logs. It really runs much, much better. So this is a very good thing to look into for disaster recovery. Another thing that we found was we ran recoveries 10 wide. This is something that may vary based on your mileage. You've got to look at what it is in your shop. Some reasons you might want to look at 10 wide. Fast log apply can do up to 10 wide. Recoveries can exploit fast log apply. What we found in our system was when we went more than 10 wide on our recoveries is that basically we reached I/O saturation. So this would be dependent on your particular configuration both in your home shop as well as at disaster recovery. And by keeping things 10 wide, we found that, you know, the log apply went much faster, and as a consequence, throttling things through like this actually improved our overall total throughput. Another thing that we found, and this was through our testing, and this you need to once again test for yourself, is we found that if we recovered all page sets, both the table spaces and indexes, and then flooded all the rebuilds of the indexes, that we actually ran faster. The reason that we noticed this was typically when we did a recovery, we would throw all of our recoveries in, and then towards the end of those recoveries, before they finished, we would start rebuilding indexes. And what we noticed was there was a difference. The recoveries really slowed down to a glacial pace once we tossed those index rebuilds in. So on one of our tests, and this was our fastest traditional tapes and trucks test ever, we put in all of our recoveries, we made all of those finish, and then and only then we started our rebuild index. And our net total recovery time was actually less than when we used the technique where we were mixing. So once again, this is something that you can investigate and try at disaster recovery and see how your results come out. Another way to improve disaster recovery is not to recover. And this has to do with remote mirroring. And there are a number of versions and techniques for doing this, but basically it's continuous data replication, which means if you have a disaster at the home site, that you can simply connect to your recovery site where you've got another copy of the data. You bring up your servers pointing to that, your mainframe and so forth, and then you go through normal crash recovery. Now, this is something that we've done in the last 2 years at our site, and our disaster recovery went from about 26 hours of DB2 recovery down to basically the time it took to restart DB2. So this is really, really significant. Also, the other significant thing with this is that disaster recovery responsibilities are largely the venue of the DASD administrator versus the database administrator. So in our last disaster recovery test, we didn't even send a DBA or a systems programmer to do our recovery because it was so simple. We just VPN'd in and verified the results. So this is something to look at, especially with the 21st century businesses that all of us find ourselves in. And this really, really simplifies the overall process and gives the business a very, very high level of support, very, very low recovery point objectives, so very, very little data is lost, and very, very quickly they get connectivity and recovery of their system. So this is something to look at. So we've looked at a number of things that make a big, big difference. We looked at the DB2 subsystem, make sure things are properly sized, that we've enabled fast log apply. We looked at the effects of image copies, stacking on tape, copying active partition and indexes together so that we can recover them together. We looked at grouping image copies by update characteristics, and this would be important for disaster recovery. We looked at some of the housekeeping tasks like modify, recover, and routine audits that can keep us out of a recovery situation. We looked at a number of things with the recover utility, the importance of dynamic data set allocations, the number of objects we're recovering, how to retain tape mounts so we don't rewind, recovering active and partition and indexes together, and then using the parallel option to help us out as well. We looked at rebuild and recover of indexes, kind of the trade-offs of each, and some of the really, really good options like sort keys and omitting the sysutdds, the importance of using those factors. We've looked at advanced disaster recovery strategies, some of the things like balancing your copies by I/O characteristics, write characteristics, like putting archive logs on disk at disaster recovery, and even the throughput of how wide we should run when we're running recoveries at disaster recovery using the traditional tapes and truck techniques. We want to take a holistic approach to recovery. First and foremost, we want to prevent the need to recover. That's very key. Now, if we're forced to to recover, we want quick and accurate problem determination. We want recovery automation. The worst thing we can have happen is to have a lot of manual processes that are slow and intensive during a recovery time. We want to avoid errors in the recovery process. We want to make sure we come to the right recovery point, and we want to make sure that our recoveries are quick. And the only way we can do all of these things is to educate, to practice, to automate, and to execute. And when we've done that, and only when we've done that, will we have DBA success. Well, I thank you for attending this webcast, and we're now going to open it up for any questions from any of the viewers.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Now we'd like to ask that you participate in a brief electronic survey. Right after the survey, we'll take your questions. Your feedback is important to us, and we do appreciate the time you take to answer these questions. To participate, simply press the star key, followed by the number that best corresponds to your choice. Please listen to all options before making your selection. For our first question, please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. Or if it was low, press star 3. For our second question, was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference at the right level, press star 1. Not technical enough, press star 2. Or if it was more technical than I needed to hear, press star 3. For our third question, what version of DB2 for AOS are you using? If DB2.9 for ZOS, press star 1. If DB2 for ZOS version 8, press star 2. Or if DB2 for ZOS version 7, press star 3. And our final question today, we hope you enjoyed the teleconference. Please let us know if you're interested in receiving additional information or follow-up regarding the products discussed today. If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. We thank you all for your responses. At this time, we'd like to take your questions. If you do have a question today, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Once again, at this time, for any questions, please press star 1. We'll pause for just a moment. And we'll go first to Ron Poonian.
Yep. We have a question on the mirroring log. Is there a distance requirement in how far the remote mirror log can be?
Okay, the question was on how far we can mirror, essentially remote replication. If you're asynchronous, if you're using asynchronous replication, you can go, in practical terms, 1,000 miles to 1,500 is fine. If you're using synchronous replication, you have the limits with speed of light, and that puts you, I think, with some of the innovations they've done now with multiplexing, I think they've got it up to 60 or 80 miles. So it depends on the type of replication that you're doing. We've chosen asynchronous replication because we feel it's very important to get our disaster recovery site out of the area of Florida because we're very hurricane prone, and hurricanes tend to be large disasters that could disable large areas. We've opted for asynchronous replication. The disadvantages of that are that it has a little more latency involved, and it's not real time. It's not quite as real time, so we would lose potentially a couple minutes of data versus seconds.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll go next to Warner Sadie.
Hi. Hi, Robert. Thanks for this. This was interesting. I just want to ask one thing about the LPL recovery. A few times when I've done group restart disaster recovery tests, we've had hundreds of thousands of LPLs. Now, in VIAC, you said the recoveries are done, DB2 actually automatically kicks them in. Now, if I normally start the LPLs myself and I kick, 30 or 40% of the LPLs in myself, the DB2 crashes. Did you ever do tests to see how many LPLs you can run at the same time?
Yeah, first of all, we're not a data sharing environment, so I'm not going to be able to answer with authority on that. When we have done LPLs in the past, it was basically with version 6 or before, and there you had to manually detect them and do the start to clear them, in which case DB2 took care of it. With version 8, it's very much a background process, and I don't know how that would apply in your particular instance in a data sharing. So that may be something you want to ask another data sharing customer.
Okay, no problem.
We'll move next to Harry Shanmugahasan.
Robert, at one point in your presentation, you said that in your version 8 tests that you found that when you had more than two indexes, that rebuild index all was the best performing of the options and was better performing than running parallel jobs. So does that mean that tip number 23, page 39, which showed the parallel jobs as being faster, was your sort of earlier test, and that's now invalid?
Okay. Well, can you repeat the page again?
Page number 39, tip number 23.
Okay, when to use parallel. What we found is I had been a big proponent of using parallel jobs for index recoveries, and we'd used that, you know, really down through version 7. It was very successful. When we started doing benchmarks after a DR test, or at the end of the DR test, just to find out, we found that when we had over two indexes, that it was superior to use just the index all. And, that kind of overturned our apple cart because, of course, we had generated our jobs and our recoveries to using that technique of using parallel, basically putting in parallel jobs. And what that does is if you have, let's say, three or four indexes and you submit three or four separate jobs that do each of those indexes and they run in parallel, the buffer pools are basically primed once versus being primed three or four separate times. And so that gave us better performance. However, starting in version 8, we found that, you know, that was no longer valid, that the index all with sort keys was a superior performer. And that's kind of our bottom line now. Of course, now we're using a remote replication solution, so we don't actually do traditional recovery anymore, for disaster recovery anyway.
So in other words, then, that those comparisons in those charts, in that particular chart, was really only valid for version 7 and before. It's not valid now in version 8.
Right. That's something that we did from an earlier test, right, where we were comparing index all with and without sort keys and then index parallel jobs with and without sort keys. You notice in both cases the combination, and here's the bottom line, the combination of using sort keys, yes, and index all if you have several indexes, that's the sweet spot today in version 8. So, you know, one of the issues that we get into, and myself included, is, you know, we prove things in past versions of DB2, and we really have to go back and re-benchmark every time we get a new version because, you know, things are better. And in this case, IBM made significant inroads with the sort keys and with the parallelism when you use index all. And so that turns out to be in version 8 a superior technique. Now, if you wanted to do a generic, just make a decision of how to do it generically in all cases, the recommendation would be index all, sort keys, yes. And overall, if you're doing 1,000 indexes, that would be a superior way to do it.
Thank you.
Once again, that is star one for questions. We'll move next to Fernando Castillo.
Yes, my question is on page 8 you show with the DB2 tablespace and recovery concept. I'm not really a DBA, but I'm asking a question is, in recovering a tablespace, okay, you need something like syscopy, then image copy, and then we need these other points in here. We have a dormant DB2 subsystem in our test environment that is cloned just like our production. But we had lost, for some reasons, the syslog range data set to recover, to bring up the system, which just shows is unavailable. Can we take the current DB2 log branch from our production system and do like a DFDSS copy over there? And what do we need to do to possibly use that if it's possible to recover from that?
Okay, so your question was you lost your syslog range X?
Yes. And it's a clone system that we left North Dorman for a long time in our development LPAR.
Okay, so it's cloned, but obviously your production LPAR continued to move.
Yes, we're good. We're fine with the production.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to migrate your syslog range X because where your production is now, the timestamps and so forth will not match.
Okay.
In DB2, it's very sensitive in all of the components down to the page sets. There's some on the header pages. There's some timestamps in syscopies. There's timestamps, syslog range, and then the bootstrap, and then in the active logs themselves. And you could verify this by doing the report recovery utility, and that would tell you what objects were going to be used, and it also has timestamps and RBAs in there as well.
Okay.
If your clone system, your test clone system is old, and you try to move the syslog range X from production in, you're not going to fly. You're not going to fly.
Okay. Any besides just running the report to see what RBA and all that, any suggestion besides just allocating a freshly new one to slot range?
Well, I'm...
Everything has to be, like you're saying, page sets.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that would work. There may be a systems DBA that can answer that question.
Okay, okay.
So things that you can... So it's just your syslog range X is corrupted, that's it, right?
Yes.
And you don't have a copy of that you can lay down?
No, yeah, well, you know, that's why I looked at your table A and it says, we know the things that you need to recover, and a copy is the key.
Yeah, one of the things about any of the, you know, top-tier databases is they've got all sorts of little timestamps and self-correcting mechanisms in there so that you can't kind of kludge things together and get it to work, which would give them really wacko errors to try to troubleshoot. Those.
Well, if I take all the DB2 table spaces and indexes and bring them freshly to that, you know, clone DB2 subsystem, and I'm not talking about the application, I'm leaving the application the way they are, all the tables for the application or that.
I mean, you have another option, which is the clean option, which is to do a refresh.
Okay.
Refresh of everything.
Okay.
That's not a low overhead activity, but that may be one of the options that you have. You may contact IBM and ask them if there's any way to recover the syslog range X if you don't have a copy.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
And we'll take a follow-up from Hari.
Robert, when you were talking about your tests, your disaster recovery, you mentioned that when you ran more than 10 jobs wide, it saturated your I/O subsystem. And I was curious, when you run with just 10 jobs, how many actual objects are being recovered concurrently?
Okay. It depends. Typically, we will stack 60, 80 to 100 table spaces or page sets on a individual tape. We'd have 10 of those running wide. Now, remember we said fast log apply, you could have up to 10 recovery jobs use that concurrently. That's 10 in log apply. Remember, you start out, it's laying down the page sets, so not everybody would be in log apply. So you might be able to push it up and run 12, 13, 14. We found a combination because of our DASD subsystem at the DR site that we actually saturated I.O., and we could submit more jobs, but there wasn't any more net throughput. It started to page, and so we throttled it back, and that was kind of the basis of our general rule to go 10 wide.
So the way you described it, and tell me if I'm getting things wrong, I heard you say that you stack 100 sort of data sets on a tape, and it sort of sounded then that each of these tapes is handled by one job. So it sounds as if each recover job is processing a single tape serially.
Correct.
Now, why did you choose that as opposed to a single job processing 10 tapes in parallel using, you know, parallel 10 as your recover option?
Well, basically because at the time we set it up, the parallel 10 didn't exist. So part of that's a legacy question. Okay. At the time that we started this back in, we started doing DR in 91, so we've kind of grown forward now. Is that an option now to go parallel on the jobs? Yeah.
And from what I also heard you say is now you really don't care because you mirror all your things anyway.
Yeah, at this point. But the lessons that we learned are, you know, still valid. Have, you know, the mirroring accommodates us for a disaster recovery scenario. It does not accommodate us for typical DB2 recovery where we get a page set corruption or something like that, or we want to recover to a point in time. So that is a disaster recovery solution. So just because we have it doesn't mean that we may not have to employ on a limited basis the recovery techniques that we've kind of laid out. Yeah, we wouldn't normally have to do it in mass unless we lost the DASD volume.
Now, going back to one of your earlier foils, which we're comparing rebuild index versus recover index.
Oh, yeah.
I was interested in what your criteria or thresholds were when you talk about large and large periodic updated.
Yeah. You know, basically, this is first I'll say the way this works for you may vary based on your own test results, your own environment. And, you know, it would be one of those, it depends from an IBM standpoint. But to quantify for you, if we have something with more than 50 million rows in it, and it's either read-only or periodically updated, and that would be things like maybe we get a EDI, electronic data interchange that they do it three times a day. So it's a spike of updates, but most of the time it's not being updated. Those things seem to be ideal for index backup and recovery. Because of the improvements IBM's made now with the recover or the rebuild index, we actually found that it was run quicker than our recovery indexes. And what we did, we had our last disaster recovery test where we actually did traditional recovery. We finished about 8 hours early. So we didn't have anything to do, and so we thought, well, what we're going to do is we're going to go back and we're going to rebuild indexes, and then we're going to go look at the recovery index versus the rebuild index. So we would run them multiple times. We ran each one a couple of times, a couple times recovering it, a couple times rebuilding it, and then we compared. And so this is actually what we found out. So the good news is IBM has made some significant inroads on their rebuild index utility. It's running great, especially if you're using the stored keys and so forth, some of the other options, to where it was outperforming the recovery index. So the thing to do, though, is to run some benchmarks and try it for yourself and kind of get your own feel for how you would like to do it. Right now, we are mainly using the recovery index for data warehouse kinds of things. We've got big stuff with very large indexes that are basically read-only, or for things that are just very infrequently, periodically updated.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll hear next from Joe DeBellis.
Question I have is, we do our nightly image copies to disk, and then there's a job that comes along later in the stream and actually does a copy to tape. We want to use the parallel options. We have that similar problem at DR where we have tons of rewinds and unmounts. Will that parallel option work even though everything is stacked internally in that one data set after the copy to copy?
Oh.
This tape that gets created doesn't have, like, I'm talking about 101 table spaces for that application. It's not one data set with a label, one behind the other on the tape. It's copy to copy, puts them all internally inside one data set, but they're stacked in, you know.
Copy to copy. Okay, I'm not, I don't have an answer to that one. If we're using the traditional image copy where you are going, and I think you've got the ability now, you could do your on-site to disk and your off-site at the same time to tape. That would be one option. Then you could definitely use the parallel. If you're using some type of copy to copy, I'm not sure that would work.
Yeah, and the copy to copy is what we could send off-site and let's use it at disaster recovery.
Yeah, now you can employ in the copy to copy the earlier technique of allocating DDs,
right,
to retain.
Right.
We did that with a Rex that would go out. We'd actually read the DB2 catalog to determine what was stacked on tape in the right order, and then generate the JCL and the DDs with the vol sears.
Okay.
So that technique would work. I'm not sure the parallel would. The copy to copy, is that an IBM image copy function?
Yes, yes. Takes the latest and greatest image copy on disk there and then puts it on tape.
I couldn't say for sure, but it sure would be easy enough to test, wouldn't it? Just use a small subset.
Yeah, that's what I think we're going to do. We're going to test a small subset of table spaces.
Well, what you may want to do as an option, is there a restriction on the number of tape drives available normally? Well, why are you batching up afterwards? That's my question.
Yeah, that was a decision the application folks made a while ago. And I really don't. I'm the systems guy, so
yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, what you may want to look at doing is revisiting that and saying DB2, I believe, now has the ability to copy to a disk local and to a tape for your remote copy. So a tape would be spinning while it's writing it to disk. From a technical standpoint, that's actually more efficient, right? You're passing the data once, you're writing it twice. And the technique you got right now, you're reading the data, you're writing it, you're reading the data, and you're writing it again in a separate process. So there should be some economies to doing both the local and recovery site at the same in the same pass. And probably your restriction there would be if you're really constrained with tape drives or something and you have to schedule this. The other thing you're doing by doing the copy afterwards is you're actually elongating your recovery time because in your potentially recovery point as well, because if you think about it, now you've got to, let's say it takes an hour to do the copy, and then after the fact it takes you half an hour to put it on the tape.
Right, right.
Now you've got an hour and a half, whereas if they come to pull the tapes at minute 61, they get, if you did it in line with the disk copy and the tape were the same, it'd be available versus the technique you're using today, and the example would be 90 minutes, you'd miss the pull. So just another consideration. And, you know, one of the important things on all this stuff, and I think the questions are very good, is we've got to constantly go back and rethink, is this the optimal way to do this with the current technology?
Right, right.
It's changing so quick. Very good question.
So your recommendation is to get the same job they put to make the disk image copies out of, make the tape image copies out of.
Right.
So they're stacking the tape at the same time they're writing them on disk, so.
Yes.
And then the parallel would definitely work in that case because there is a physical data set.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, it's registered in syscopy, and I assume the copy to copy works that way too, but I'm not sure on that. We haven't employed that. That may be something, if you go to Information on Demand or iDug in the spring, there's a lot of good resources from the lab that you can ask those kinds of questions to.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye.
And, Mr. Goodman, there appear to be no further questions. I'll turn the conference back to you for closing remarks.
Okay. Well, we appreciate everyone taking the time out of their busy days to come and look at these recovery options. You know, traditionally, recovery was a very important part of DB2. It still is. It's just that we don't do it very often. The way it is today, it's fairly rare that we have table breakages and data corruptions in DB2. And that's a really good thing. I know we started early on in DB2 land, and there was a lot of recoveries we had to do early on, and it's just a fairly rare thing. But it doesn't eliminate the need to still have good recovery skills and knowledge. And so we would encourage everyone to kind of look at these things. Hopefully we've offered some new tips and techniques that you can go back and say, well, maybe I can revamp some things I've done. We'd encourage you to automate everything in your recovery process. Very important as well. So I appreciate you taking the time. And for those of you that have an opportunity, I'll be speaking at Information on Demand on remote replication. So we'll kind of get into the some more aspects of that if that piqued your interest at all. So thank you once again.
That does conclude today's conference call. Have a pleasant day.